to overthrow suppression and make ourselves heard till they finally get the message. And let them know the power of the people is a weapon they don't wanna fuck with unless they down for Armageddon. Can't waste another second, I'ma fight until the evil deceased. Stay online trying to take away your freedom of speech. You don't fit the narrative or keep the people asleep. You get your platform stripped for deceiving the weak. It's fucked up, and honestly we gotta make a change. The freedoms that we have are all at stake, cause the currency inflates. They season every dollar in your bank just for questioning the power that's in place. They got us in restraints, but they will never censor me. Best believe I'ma fight till I rest in peace. Yes indeed, the slave ship isn't for me. I'd rather die on my feet than to live on my knees.
So, who here is PR trained? Not me. I'm not PR trained. What's PR training? Sounded like the beginning of an ad, wasn't it? For like for some PR training ad, PR training company, whatever. So I was able to sufficiently embarrass myself over the weekend. Well, it wasn't even my fault. For whatever reason, my computer was acting all silly and wonky. I was like, all right, well, always acts all silly and wonky, so we're just gonna go ahead and deal with this. So I got my guest on the phone and we're getting ready, and I even do the intro, only to find out that my audio equipment again isn't working. Again, for the second guest, for the second time. So my guest came up with a solution, an alternate way to record the podcast, and however how he does it via Zoom and such. And quite literally, the second he presses record on Zoom, my computer freezes. And it didn't unfreeze for a very long time. I had to shut it down and all this other crazy shit, and audio still wasn't working. Yeah. I had to go and grab another little notebook. No worries. No worries. I got the notebook though. I got it. And my mom's supposed to be giving me her computer that's broken, or I don't know. At some point I'm just going to have like 3 or 4 computers here, and it's just going to be a fucking graveyard. So because I was able to sufficiently embarrass myself via all of that bullshit, I wanted to do some solo stuff today, this morning, yada yada, and do a couple articles that he posted. So it'd be like a little special edition for this person. I don't want to put their name out there, what they do and all this other shit. But if you know, you know. And it's always good to be in the know, right? Here at Cushion Coffee, where we provide leading, cutting-edge articles and read them to you in a robust, beautiful broadcaster voice. That's right. Whilst smoking marijuana. So this article from Psychology Today, very interesting. It's the therapeutic potential of altered states of consciousness. Who does that sound like? Altered state of consciousness. That sounds like a very interesting concept here. Let's jump right into it. It's a very interesting topic. There is a long history in the fields of psychology and psychiatry of using non-ordinary states of consciousness, sometimes referred to altered states, to facilitate deep psychological work. These approaches have included guided imagery, hypnosis, LSD-assisted psychotherapy, and holotropic breathwork, to name a few. Current research and theories related to psychedelic assisted therapies may help us understand what these approaches have in common and why they are so impactful. Now, I've spent a long time in therapy as a young child and after as an adolescent. For reasons that you may or may not know, but it doesn't matter. And not once was I exposed to any of this. Guided imagery, never in a clinical setting, no, not by a licensed therapist. I've never had guided imagery by a licensed therapist. I've had guided imagery. I've never been hypnotized. And I've definitely never had LSD-assisted psychotherapy. Not entirely sure if that would help, but it's probably microdosed. Probably. Several studies have recently suggested that the therapeutic value of psychedelic experiences may lie in their ability to increase or facilitate mental flexibility, insight, and acceptance. Now, I talked about this in one of my earlier podcasts. Is I kind of said it like, well, I mean, your brain is a data processor, if you can think of it that way, like a computer. And what psychedelics do is it increases the amount of data it can process. Now, this article goes on to say something like that, just in a more scientific, you know, convoluted way. So that's why colors are really bright and soft things are super soft and, you know, things, you know, all of that great stuff. So it's just, it increases the amount of data your brain can process. Let's see. One of the leaders in the field of psychedelic research, Robin Carhart Harris, has proposed an entropic theory of consciousness to help explain and understand how this process might work. Essentially, this theory suggests that many or most mental health concerns are associated with a reduced level of psychological and cognitive flexibility. In essence, the brain slash mind becomes stuck in certain patterns that are no longer useful to the person. By introducing a powerful experience that shifts awareness into a broader perspective and expression, it is possible to help the mind become unstuck when this process is conducted in a therapeutic context. With ongoing therapy, it can potentially enhance outcomes. Yeah, like I'm with most of that. Theory suggests that many or most mental health concerns are associated with reduced level of psychological and cognitive flexibility. Yes. And no. Yes and no. Some would argue that it's associated with a high level of psychological and cognitive flexibility. Like, too flexible. Almost malleable. Let's see. The psychological slash cognitive flexibility, or lack thereof, can be described in terms of entropy. The term entropy originally comes from the field of thermodynamics to describe the direction of change in a system. Technically, it is a measure of the amount of energy available to do work. So, higher levels of entropy imply more energy, which includes less structure and greater uncertainty. Low levels of entropy exist in systems that are rigid and have less energy for change. You can see why this concept makes sense in the context of psychological flexibility. Essentially, higher entropy equals greater flexibility. Neuroscientists have figured out a variety of methods to measure the amount of entropy in the brain, allowing us to examine what types of psychological interventions can be used to increase brain flexibility. Not surprisingly, research with psychedelics has consistently demonstrated greater entropy during psychedelic states. However, not everyone is interested in gaining cognitive psychological flexibility working with psychedelic medicines. Nah, that makes sense. That makes sense. It's like, I can hear it. Can you make Can you bring me to an altered state of consciousness whilst continuing the stigma of psychedelics? Oh, I meant, you know, without giving me psychedelics. Eat the cap and shut up. That's right. Oh, man. Let's see. Oh, I didn't even light up. Shit. Need to get that going. Shit. I got an early day and a far drive, but I don't care. Let's see here. Where are we at? Is it possible that other interventions, particularly those involved in creating altered states of consciousness, also lead to increased entropy? The preliminary answer appears to be yes. For example, research on Vipassana meditation has shown that practice increases the entropy within alpha and gamma brainwave bands. All right. Backtrack here. Vipassana, however you say it, it means to see things as they really are. It's apparently India's most ancient techniques of meditation. Pause. Backtrack here. Forms of modern slavery include slavery by ownership, government conscription, which is forced military service or government labor, forced prison labor, forced migrant labor, debt bondage, slavery until debts are paid, sexual slavery, forced marriage / child marriage, child labor, and forced begging. With the definition of modern slavery in mind, we can now move on to examining the statistics. The top 10 countries with the highest prevalence of modern slavery by the total number of slaves, Global Slavery Index 2018, India, at almost 8 million slaves. Question. Why? Why? Answer. There isn't one. Now allow me to superimpose my own push for meditation. Seated meditation will literally do the same exact thing. Not entirely sure why Psychology Today guy is pushing Vipassana, or however you say it. But it doesn't matter. Because, interesting, meditation and psychedelics share other brain changes as well, including decreased activity in the posterior cingulate cortex, the hub of the default mode network. All right. Well, I mean, without trying to sound super scientific, right? You know what I'm saying? It's just basically like the default mode network is just like a bunch of sections in your brain that handle like your emotions, who you are, your awareness, your consciousness. here, hold on here. I have actually a pretty good article here about that. The default mode network is a large-scale brain network primarily composed of medial prefrontal cortex, posterior cingulate cortex, and the angular gyrus. Is best known for being active when a person is not focused on the outside world and the brain is at a wakeful rest, such as during daydreaming and mind wandering. It can also be active during detailed thoughts related to external tasks performance. Other times the DMN is active include when the individual is thinking about others, thinking about themselves, remembering the past, and planning for the future. There's your little rundown on the default mode network. Let's see here. This shift in the DMN may be important for mental health, as this network in the brain is associated with self-referencing. the way we create our identity and think about ourselves in relation to the world. It may be important for mental health as this network, and it's not associated. I mean, whatever, I'm not going to argue. When this network is overactive, it often leads to rumination and or brooding. Yeah. In a series of pilot studies, our team examined Psychology Today, I'm guessing. There is no real, who's your team? Our team examined brain changes in relation to a variety of altered state interventions that did not involve the use of psychedelic medicines. These trials include examinations of soma breathwork, vibroacoustic therapy or VAT, sound self virtual reality meditation, and cannabis used in a psychedelic therapeutic setting. Medicinal mindfulness, I love it. Initially, we were interested in the likelihood of decreased MNN activity, similar to that observed during the use of psychedelics and meditation as discussed above. In all of our previous or preliminary studies, this is precisely what we found. For example, the image below, which you can't see, is a comparison of alpha brainwave activity before and after sound self VR experience. Cooler colors, blue, indicated decreased activity. When comparing the two recordings, as you can see, there was a significant decrease in activity observed in the area of the brain that serves as the hub for the default mode. Yes, there is, yeah. Right up, yeah. So, in this image, I mean, I'm going to link the link to the article in the description and all the blah 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 so you can see it, but maybe I can figure that out. We'll get the image up, be able to do this in live. But yeah, it's just an image of your brain and then back towards the back of the brain, or the posterior region, I should say. The back of the brain. It's all blue. It's just like a big ball of blue. And then it's green and then red up top left. As a follow-up, we were also curious if these same interventions showed increases in entropy. Interestingly, when we ran these analyses, the findings were somewhat inconsistent. In some cases, participants showed increases in entropy during the altered states interventions. And in other cases, they did not. However, it is important to explore why some people experience increased entropy during these interventions and others experience decreased entropy. Similar to psychedelics, we suspect that the set and setting of the experience will play a large role in influencing the brain's responses to the intervention. Perhaps if these interventions were couched in the same framework as psychedelic interventions, we would see more consistent results. Of course, these are questions for researchers to explore. While we need controlled studies to verify these findings, if confirmed, this idea would potentially open the door to a whole range of altered states approaches to therapy that do not require psychedelic medicines, in addition as a part of preparation process for therapeutic sessions with psilocybin, ketamine, or MDMA. These other approaches may serve as a softer entry point into learning to become more comfortable with altered states, potentially making a full-blown psychedelic experience more productive. Interesting concept. I am still not sold on the whole MDMA thing. I mean, I'm barely sold on ketamine. Totally sold on psilocybin, though. That shit'll fucking rock your world. Let's see here. I know I got another one. Yes, this is another one that Mr. Guy of Guys posted. Yeah, that was such an unfortunate event this weekend. Not happy about that. Not happy. However, we are recovering and moving on from that, right? That's how you got to do it. Because, you know, it's not what happens to you. It's your reaction to it, right? You know, because my computer, shit on me. I could have just, said fuck it and gave up and threw everything out or sold it or fucking. I was just like, no, let's fucking let's get another one. Let's get it going. Let's keep it keeping. You know what I'm saying? I was what, a day removed? Shit. A day. All right. So, yeah. All right. Yeah. Here it is. This is in Psychology Today. This is psych.com. And it is how to revive your sense of wonder. That childhood urge to ask how and why usually fades. But we can all learn to rediscover the joys of wide-eyed discovery by Frank Keel. Humans grow up with a powerful drive to learn how things work and why certain patterns and properties exist in the world. Wonder, a word with multiple related meanings, has one sense that captures this desire to know. You employ wonder when you ask questions such as, how do fish breathe underwater? Or why do air conditioners drip water? Wonder, as I describe it here, is more than the sort of curiosity that motivates someone to seek a simple factual answer. Example, what is the biggest kind of dog? Wonder moves someone to seek out explanations, especially about the patterns of cause and effect that underlie phenomena. It is also different from awe, which can occur as a more passive state of amazement. Wonder involves active thought and engagement, and it invokes conjectures about how and why. It might even launch speculations about different possible worlds. Wonder motivates targeted explorations and discoveries. I like that sentence. Wonder motivates targeted explorations and discoveries. This writer is a fucking genius. I love this guy already. This guy is great. Writer, let's see, Frank Keel. No link. We'll get to it. Frank Keel is the Charles C. and Dorothea S. Dilley Professor of Psychology and Linguistics at Yale. Hopefully he doesn't listen to me. He'd be like, who is this schmuck reading my shit? Oh, man. Anyway, in its most mature forms, in adults who have flourished as lifelong wanderers, wonder promotes sustained excavation of the rich casual architectures of the world. All right, relax here. Relax. It helps us to appreciate everything around us more fully. We come to see a more richly textured and dynamic reality. For example, through wondering and learning about how and why songbirds sing, how the first flowers break through frozen ground, and how animals hibernate, we come to see and experience the first days of spring in a more immersive and rewarding ways. Each instance of wondering in turn launches a branching network of new instances and opens a door to the potentially endless joy of successive discoveries. If this sounds overly euphoric, it is exactly how renowned polymaths describe their lives from childhood to their final moments. Now, I mean, this is how my vocabulary goes up. I have a decent vocabulary, but that's the first time I've, what is a polymath? All right, so great question. A polymath is an individual whose knowledge spans a substantial number of subjects, known to draw on complex bodies of knowledge to solve specific problems. Huh. Interesting. Well, that's what a polymath is. Renowned polymath. Wonder and the learning it encourages enable us to more fully engage with others, not just about topics such as cosmology or evolution, but also pressing current issues such as epidemics and climate crisis. It can also help provide a shield against misinformation. Even the most schematic understanding of gravity, stars and planets, for instance, can make one more suspicious of casual claims by astrologers. Dubious ideas, including notions about disease or climate risk that run contrary to the specific consensus, are easier to question if we acquire rough renderings of the mechanisms involved. Huh. Let's back up here for a second, because I feel like we exited how to have a life of wonder and learning, and entered dubious thoughts, including notions about disease or climate risk that run contrary to the scientific consensus, are easier to question if we acquire rough renderings of the mechanisms involved. Rough renderings. That's a pairing of a word. Should I have done this article? No, Anthony. Probably fucking not. But am I gonna? I'm sure. Rough rendering. Huh. I guess that's a fancy way of saying sketches. If we acquire a sketch of the mechanism. Sophisticated elements of wondering appear at an early age. Around 40 years ago, a pair of British researchers, Barbara Tizard and Martin Hughes, investigate children's spontaneous questions. Finding that children were asking them soon after they started using language. At first, the questions might be simple requests for the whereabouts of a favorite toy, but soon they were asking more why questions, such as why some roofs are steeply slanted and others are not, why babies can't drink really sweet drinks, and why you have to pay people money for doing things for you. More recent studies show that wonder expands greatly in power and scope in the preschool years as children learn how to go deeper and deeper in their understanding of the hidden workings of things and learn how to rely upon the knowledge in other minds. Research has even revealed early versions of enthusiastic wondering in pre-verbal infants. These signs of wondering occur when an object doesn't act as it should, such as when it seems to pass through a solid wall. The surprised infant might immediately start to explore and manipulate the object to figure out why, perhaps by banging it against the surface. Wonder commonly declines with age, but it doesn't have to. Around the time children enter classrooms, their spontaneous questions seem to plummet. Huh. Even worse, this abandonment of wonder can persist indefinitely. This decline happens at all levels of affluence and across diverse groups and cultures, leading some to worry that it is inevitable. This is written by a professor, so a professor wouldn't connect the timeline. Well, maybe he would. But is it age? Does wonder commonly decline with age? Or is it the classroom? A professor would probably say it's age. That's just the reality of it. Yet some people remain lifelong joyful wanderers. What makes them able to sustain their wonder? Consider their biochemist Jennifer Doudna, who launched the CRISPR gene editing revolution in biology. She recalls wondering constantly about the plants around her when she was growing up in Hawaii. She became fascinated with how certain plants closed up protectively when touched, and more generally, why and how plants developed ways to survive specific threats. In adolescence, she became fascinated with how genes mediate the adaptations of organisms to their environments. Let's see. After more than 50 years involved in experimental research on how both adults and children make sense of the world around them, I have become ever more impressed by the ability of young humans to sense something important lurking beneath the surface of things. They quickly grasp that uncovering how something works is especially rewarding. An intrinsic joy is at the heart of what makes this happen. All of us should experience the pleasures of learning through wonder every day of our lives. Through studies in my lab at Yale and countless discussions with other researchers and notable wanderers, I've been able to collect a number of practical strategies that can help you revive your wonder and maintain it at levels that become so rewarding that they are self-sustaining. Now, as I continue to do these articles, I'm starting to, have to say it more often. These articles are very personalized, obviously. So when I say things like I've been able to collect a number of practical strategies, I'm obviously not talking about myself. Now, as I continue doing this, this type of disclaimer is going to fade and it's just going to start appearing in my descriptions. Now, what to do? You had the need to know. There's another section. This article is sectioned wonderfully. I'm going to link it, and I hope you give it a physical view. Conduct regular introspections. I like that word, introspections. Ask yourself, have you learned anything new in the past month that has changed how you view or understand some aspect of the world? This might include learning important new facts or realizing that you were mistaken in some way about a prior view. Think about these updates in your understanding as opportunities that enable you to see the world more clearly. It would be the ultimate form of hubris to assume that one already understands everything just right. Uncovering pockets of ignorance or misunderstanding and gaining new insights can feel invigorating. Leading scientists freely admit not knowing as a primary reason for conducting research, and you can follow their lead. I love that whole paragraph. It's just beautifully written. It adds to the theory that I'm a natural leader. That's neither here nor there. You can begin to embrace the spirit of seeking new understanding by making a point of pausing on the first day of every month and asking what new insights have you recently gained or what misunderstandings you have resolved. When you identify an instance, think about what has changed in your mind and what new lines of inquiry have been revealed as a result of this change. Almost always, you will have several novel things to explore. If nothing comes to mind during your introspection, take a few minutes to reflect on what's around you. For example, as I sit here writing this sentence, I can look around the room or outside the window and quickly find an area of ignorance. On an early spring day, looking outside, my attention lingers for a moment on a lone cluster of daffodils. In interrogating my own knowledge, I realized that I've enjoyed seeing the first flowers of spring all my life. But I have no idea why daffodils come up early while all other flowers, such as roses, appear much later. This line of inquiry quickly unrolls a rich tapestry of follow-up questions about whether the early flowers tend to be ones with bulbs and why that might be the case. Interesting. Even at such early stages of wonder about a new topic, you quickly come to look at the object of your wonder differently and experience it more deeply. To find out more, you might start searching for answers online. Or if the right search phrase or source of information is not obvious, you might have to ask a friend who is knowledgeable about the subject how they suggest learning more. That discussion could in turn lead to a visit to your local library, or perhaps to an expert in your community. After a few months of regular introspections, you'll likely find yourself doing them more spontaneously because it is so rewarding. Embrace the proliferation of wonder. When you wonder, try to approach a question with the expectation that you're just taking the first step in what might turn out to be a many possible cycles of branching paths of wondering, each one triggered by what you learn in response to the prior question. The natural world and the world of technology are both full of complex, nested systems. Consider the components of a car and how each of these, engine, brakes, transmission, etc., has its own complexities and internal parts with additional complexities. What this means is that you should be on the lookout for what new wriggling worms appear when you overturn your first rock of inquiry through wondering. For example, if you find out that slime molds can solve mazes and wonder how that happens, then learn that they leave behind slime trails as a form of external memory, you might immediately start asking how they read such trails and use them. Adopt diverse ways of wondering. You can experience extra pleasure and information foraging when you discover a new way of learning more. Alternatives to the standard search engine query, as helpful as they can be, might include seeking out YouTube videos created by experts or visiting online forums such as Reddit Explain Like I'm 5. You can also explore lectures or other educational events at nearby science museums or colleges. Do not feel shy about asking experts you meet to help you about understanding a subject. While some experts might not want to explain things to a novice, many, including those who are leaders in their field, are thrilled to share their excitement and help you see why they have devoted so much of their life to a topic. Even some doctors, despite crushing schedules, might still be happy to have a patient who becomes more of an intellectual partner in understanding what is going on. Emails out of the blue to experts you haven't met might not always work because of the sheer volume they receive, but it is often quite easy to approach an expert after a talk or an other event. If a topic of interest seems especially complex, looking back at its early history can provide a useful entry point. For example, say you became interested in the concept of electromagnetism. Entering the topic by reading the mathematical models might be intimidating. Even back in the early 1860s, James Clerk Maxwell's four equations required a fair bit of mathematical understanding. Yet if you go back just a few more decades and read a book about the pioneering scientist Michael Faraday, and perhaps some excerpts from his notebooks, you can quickly gain a vivid, almost mathematics-free sense of many key phenomena. The more you approach a topic from different vantage points and perspectives, the more you start to see the phenomenon under investigation emerge in all its beauty and complexity. Look for anomalies and puzzles. Wonder will often go into high gear when you're confronted with an apparent anomaly or puzzle. Sometimes people ignore anomalies as annoying exceptions to a simple explanatory story that they have in mind. But very often, an anomaly can be extremely revealing and cause a revamping of your understanding. For instance, you might notice that a particular tree in your town loses its leaves much earlier than all others. At first, you just ignore the anomaly. But when you eventually decide to look up why this might be the case, you learn that the trees often lose their leaves earlier when they are stressed by poor soil conditions and or a toxic substance. You now better appreciate how trees provide information about the quality of the local environment. Here's another example. Perhaps you learn that many political scientists recommend ranked choice voting systems, yet these systems are far from universal. When you start to consider why this is the case, you begin to wonder all sorts of things about voting. You explore what reasons are given for and against ranked choice voting and other types. You might ask whether implementing this kind of voting has unanticipated consequences in addition to the suggested benefits. You start to better appreciate the many intertwined processes involved in practically implementing fair and efficient voting systems. Similarly, if you stop and try and explain yourself or others how various ordinary things work, you might find that there are gaps in your understanding. Whether it is your grasp of how a flush toilet works or how the heart pumps blood, when you stumble upon such gaps, appreciate that you have just uncovered an opportunity to unleash wonder and to explore why something works the way it does. Explore contrasting cases. A range of studies has shown the value of contrasting cases for learning more deeply about a topic. For example, your understanding of the concept of mammal will likely deepen after you compare various pairs of mammals and consider the commonalities of differences between them. You might also wonder about the similarities and differences between two related concepts in psychology or another field. Concepts such as extrinsic or motivation, extrinsic motivation or intrinsic motivation, and by contrasting them, learn about larger topic, motivation, and how experts think about it. A vivid example of how power contrasting cases in my own life concerns the planets Earth and Venus. I grew up in the 1950s and 60s thinking of Venus as our twin planet. It is almost the same size, only a little closer to the sun and covered with clouds, which suggested that it might have lots of water and a climate that could support life. My visions of Venus were supported by science fiction of that period, such as Ray Bradbury's story, All Summer in a Day, 1954, that presented Venus as a warmer, more humid version of the Earth. So, I was recently staggered to learn that Venus is now considered the evil twin, because it is so different from the Earth in ways that it's hostile to life. For example, the mean surface temperature is an astonishing 864 degrees Fahrenheit, and the atmosphere consists mostly of carbon dioxide, nitrogen, and sulfuric acid. It is about as lethal a place for humans as one could find. Love it. This contrast launched me into a wonder-propelled effort to find out how two planets of the same mass could have such different environments. As I explored the topic, I came to see why the solar system is truly a system, with interactions between planets and asteroids over time that may have led to the huge contrast. I also learned how clouds can become vehicles for runaway global warming. Runaway global warming. I still have much more to learn, but even at this point, when I look at the night sky and easily locate Venus, I see and experience a completely different thing. Not as the friendly twin where Earthlings might live in a few decades, but as an example of how Earth's status as a livable planet might be far more fragile than we realize. Yeah, that's not my takeaway. My bad. My takeaway is that humans are not very far from removed from when we thought cutting ourselves cured common colds. Now we think injecting ourselves with random shit will cure common colds. I don't think shit has changed. Anyway, moving on. Entertain counterfactuals. Yeah. Wonder is most powerful when it uncovers the casual structures that lie beneath, obviously. I'll stop. I'm sorry. And are responsible for surface phenomena. These structures often include elaborate and extensive branches. so that each how or why question can launch a cascade of follow-up questions. Many recent studies show that posing counterfactual questions is an excellent way to peel away appearances to see the workings underneath. In asking such questions, you provide fuel for wonder. For example, you might ask, what would the world be like if water contracted when it froze? Like most liquids, rather than expanded. If you think it through on your own and then consult some sources, you might be astonished to learn just how important that very unusual feature of water is. Indeed, some experts believe that this property of water is essential to life on Earth. To grasp such claims fully, you will find yourself coming up with a number of follow-up questions. That I think you're pushing us to do research on things that support your theories in climate. That's what I think. I'm just kidding. Oh, you're a very intelligent doc, prof, whatever you are. How do you know what to counterfactualize? It is much more interesting to wonder what transportation would be like if the speed of light was 100 miles per hour than to wonder what it would be like if all wheeled vehicles had blue wheels. Why is one counterfactual so much more interesting? It has to do with the ramifications of changing such an important property as the speed of light. If you engage in counterfactual exercises regularly, you will develop a better sense of the sorts of what-if questions that are likely to be most revealed. But most of us know right from the start that some attributes of the world are more interesting to imagine transforming than others. All right. Practice win-win wonderings with others. One way to reawaken wonder lies in your interactions with others. Many adults see arguments as aversive battles, with the goal of conquering the other with your point of view. But this quote-unquote argue-to-win perspective neglects the opportunity that disagreements offer for expanding wonder. To take advantage of this, we need to adopt an argue-to-learn mindset. Now, I spoke a lot of this is when you eliminate the emotion from a situation and you derive the education from it. You objectively learn it and analyze it. That's basically what I always said. So, I mean, can you think back to an argument when everyone exchanged views with no fear of losing, quote unquote, when getting closer to the truth, not winning was the focus and all sides made positive contributions? All too often, we fall into a zero-sum framing of disagreements when, in fact, win-win encounters are also possible and more rewarding for all parties. The next time you find yourself disagreeing with a friend, try to embrace that disagreement as an opportunity to learn and communicate. Let your friend know that you want to argue in good faith and that you would be delighted to have your mind changed as you can learn more that way. Following through on this commitment to learn almost invariably involves asking why and how questions. There are other simple ways to promote arguing to learn. One of the easiest is to have arguments with another person without an audience and with an agreement that details of who knew what at the beginning of the conversation are of no concern to anyone else. Create a checklist for wondering. Checklists can be surprisingly useful for helping you engage effectively in a variety of desired activities, including wondering. Suppose you wonder about the costs and benefits of a particular public health intervention. Given that emotions can be biased how we approach and value information, you might be especially vigilant by using a checklist with items such as following. Did I consult at least 3 different sources? Did I make sure those 3 didn't get all of their information from 1 common source? Did I check the reputation of all my sources by looking at their affiliations, their training, and other indicators that they are respected for the quality of their views? Did the sources actually discuss any mechanisms involved? For example, how a vaccine works in more than a hand-waving manner, kind of like what I did earlier when I said, inject yourself with random shit to stop common colds. Or did they rely on more personal anecdotes or opinions, kind of like what I did? Badly informed sources rarely dive deeply into mechanisms. Bullshit. Bullshit. I am a badly informed source that has dived deeply into mechanisms. I'm only badly informed because of all the other aforementioned bullshit, because my reputation of my sources, by looking at my affiliations and their training and other indicators that they're respected for the quality of their views. No, doc, I'm a know nothing. I don't do shit. I don't know anybody. I just know that you can't cure a virus with a fucking vaccine. That's all I know. Exactly how and why and when and what? I don't know. Nor do I fucking care. I just know, along with 1,000 other virologists, you can't cure a virus. Period. You can't cure viruses. You can cure viruses that don't mutate, like polio. But viruses, like I said the other day, viruses that mutate become mild. They become more transmissible, but more mild. It's the nature of a virus. For a virus to break that structure, it would be reaching outside the, you know, its physical limitations. Now, do I have friends and doctors and virologists to support me and back me up on that? No. But do I need them? No. And what's really interesting about this article is that this professor didn't mention a fucking thing about suicide, right? I mentioned more, a little bit about mental health, more about climate, about how to vet the people that you're talking to. Like, who the fuck is this article for? Sorry, original person, you know, that posted this. It's just irritating. It's just irritating. I mean, like, it's just common fucking knowledge that you can't cure a fucking virus with a vaccine. That's why HIV still exists. And are we just going to ignore the fact that he mentioned everything besides the leading cause of death in America, which is, it's not suicide, and it's not COVID, and it's not drug overdose, even though that's what most of us talk about? It's fucking cancer by a large margin. Malignant neoplasms kill like 3 times more than the second leading cause. I think this is fucking diabetes or heart disease. I think heart disease was like 250,000, but cancer was like fucking 600 and something thousand people a year or some crazy shit like that. It's like, you're a professor, you're a leading edge thinker, a cutting edge thinker in your field, and you want to revive wonder via telling people to research climate and to believe in vaccines. Now, I really feel like all of the other bullshit was just fluff, you know? It's just fluff. And then like they're just drilled on some key points, on points that seemed like he wanted to. I feel like all universities do shit like this. They just like implement and like and I don't even want to say it's not even subliminal. I can't even say it's subliminal because it's right there in fucking front of you. If it's subliminal implies that they're tricking you, and it's not even a trick. They're telling you. It's right there. They're not even hiding it. Subliminal would mean that they're hiding it, and it's right there in fucking front of you. I was all with that article up until that point in time. My apologies if that offends anyone. Well, actually, no. Thanks for listening. Stay lifted. Cushion coffee.